Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Did you know that you can cross over a drawbridge and enter a castle every day and every night? Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to the last of our Spirit of Things summer highlights here on ABC Radio National. For the past 4 weeks, we've been featuring our spiritual classic series from 2007, and today we'll hear about the Catholic saint Teresa of Avila and her most famous work, The Interior Castle, and what it means to one of the New Age's most charismatic spiritual leaders, Carolyn Mace. Then we leap 400 years hence and reconsider John T. Robinson's Honest to God, a book that made it to the front page of Time magazine after it was published in 1963. It became a watershed in the life of a North Carolina Anglican priest, Jack Spong. Since then, he too has changed the way many people, not only Christians, think about God. The retired Bishop Spong will join me later in the program, and he gives a brilliantly lucid response to the fundamentalists, as well as to the atheists. But first, Carolyn Mace.
I cross the bridge into the silent bliss of my interior castle. I close the drawbridge and forbid all outside influences from entry into this holy place that is my soul. Here in my castle, I am alone with God. I embrace the power of prayer. I open myself to divine guidance, and I surrender myself to become as a channel for grace, healing, and service as God directs my life.
That's just the beginning of a prayer by Carolyn Mace. I first learned about Carolyn at a Catholic education conference where I discovered her books were popular. I was surprised because she's a leading figure in the New Age and claims to be a medical intuitive healer, and her book, Sacred Contracts with the Universe, seemed a tad out of place there. But as you'll hear today, her background is Catholic, and she takes her inspiration from a leading Catholic mystic, Teresa of Avila. And that's who we'll be talking about today, particularly her famous work, The Interior Castle.
Teresa was a 16th century Spanish Carmelite. She was a great, great, great mystic. And she was a rare woman. She was a wild young woman whose father put her in a convent to protect her from getting too wild. And he never intended that she would be inspired to become a nun, but she did. She was, and she did. And by the time she was 19, she was in a Carmelite convent. And I'll fast forward and say that Carmelites are cloister. But today, most people would know that. I don't know if you have a lot of Carmelite convents here in Australia.
Not many.
I don't think so. They're more typical in Europe, and certainly there are Carmelite convents in America, Trappist Carmelite. But in the Carmelite rule, the women or the men, they take vows to live within a cloister, to not ever leave the monastery. And that's an important feature here. But anyway, Teresa was a Carmelite. When she was 39 years old, she had what's called a conversion experience. And that's a critical part of this her life, because up until that time, she was just an ordinary nun. But when she turned 39, she had an experience of profound mystical awakening in which she experienced an emotional, psychic, spiritual soul connection to Christ. And in that moment, her whole life became a spiritually animated life.
She was prolific.
She was prolific. She became the first doctor of the Catholic Church as a woman. She wrote her autobiography. She wrote Progress of the Soul. And she wrote her last great piece, which is called The Interior Castle. This book has been studied for centuries. What it is that Teresa had such a rich interior life that toward the end of her life, her spiritual director said, you have to write about what it is you have experienced when you go into prayer, what is it that you have learned about the soul that is so extraordinary? Because the rest of us want to know where you go when you close your eyes. By the time Teresa was in her 50s in the convent, not only did her sisters, the nuns that she lived with, realize that they were living with a saint, but the whole of Spain knew that, as well as Rome, the Vatican. Her experiences, her mystical experiences, had become famous, even though she was a cloistered nun. All right. She had, of course, by this time started other convents. She was an abbess. But let me just give you an example. She would sometimes levitate.
Levitate?
Yes.
Other people witnessed this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, mind you, don't picture her on the ceiling, Rachel. She would go into states of ecstasy where she would hover over the ground by 2 inches or something like that. Now, that's not unusual. I mean, in the sense that Eastern mystics has been seen to do that.
I've read that her face was illuminated.
Her face would be illuminated. She had a number of mystical experiences that were so profound that other people witnessed them. They knew that something of a great, profound nature was going on between her and God. And so she wrote The Interior Castle. There are so many things about this book.
Indeed.
That struck me as being outstanding. Not the least of which was that she said she had a vision of the soul. And she said the soul was like a crystal with 7 mansions. And the fact that she said 7, when I've written Anatomy of the Spirit years ago, I took a model, a template, trying to describe the relationship between the 7 chakras, the 7 sacraments, the 7 levels of the tree of life, the fundamental 7 levels of power, and our biology, and wove it together, taking the sacred traditions, all of which use the template of 7. You know, here I am 12, 14 years later, and I'm reading the work of Teresa that says, and now we go into the soul.
And the castle is the soul.
Yes, she used the metaphor of the castle, and she said the soul is a castle, and it's the deeper part of yourself that can only be accessed through prayer. And what she was saying is that you have to pull away from your 5 senses, from your ego, and move deeply, deeply into your interior self. So
how much is that an intellectual exercise, and how much is it something beyond that?
The intellect can't get to the soul, Rachel, any more than now I'm completely convinced that the intellect cannot help you heal. I am absolutely convinced now, after working with Teresa's work for so long, and working in the castle, and working with people, helping them enter the castle.
And yet it is a book that she wrote that you read with your intellect. So it's got to be active in some way.
But she addresses that. You know, she addresses that you will have a struggle here. That's why the 3rd mansion is called the defeat of reason. One of the most difficult things, obstacles to the entry into your soul, is to defeat the love we have of our own intellect and our need to have everything in life be reasonable, to have a reasonable God, to have a reasonable force, to make sense, to have, this is the way we structure things. We say things like, there must be a reason for this. I wonder what God was thinking. There must be a reason why things happen as they do, because we actually think that this is a logical and orderly universe according to our personal map, Rachel. We actually think that.
So is she elaborating another kind of map that one has
yes.
to progress along?
Exactly. What she's saying is you have to get through your need to have an image of God where God is a fair, reasonable being, and get past that and begin to trust that there is a loving God that has your best interests at heart and move into this idea, God is not an idea. Move into an experience. I first have to state that Teresa was a mystic. She was a mystical theologian. And a mystic is someone who experiences God rather than talks about God. And therein lies the first significant difference between how Teresa understood the nature of God versus people who talk about the nature of God. Teresa experienced God. When she wrote The Interior Castle, she wrote it as a map preparing people for the experience of God, a map of illumination through which prayer was a primary requisite.
Now, people thinking about that would say, well, Teresa of Avila was living in the 16th century. She was an abbess. She was within a monastery. What does it have to say to us today who are living in the midst of our lives, our jobs, our families?
It's a great question.
Is this where your book comes in a way, to provide a segue from what she was saying?
That's a great question and wonderful. This is what I absolutely believe, Rachel. No matter where I go in the world, I think we're living in a mystical renaissance. I really do. I think we are living at a time where there is a mystical awakening, where people are being called to be mystics out of monasteries. You know, there was a time, like in Teresa's time, or Francis of Assisi, or any of the great mystics of the Christian Catholic tradition, or the great mystics of the Buddhist tradition, or the Hindu tradition, of the Islamic tradition, when they would be called to live within monasteries or ashrams, because that's what that time and that era called for. Today, the new mystic is someone like you and me, who lives an ordinary life in the world with an extraordinary spiritual life. We have, for the last 50 years, a hybrid spirituality that we've created. We've combined health and yoga and vegetarianism and relaxation and therapy, and we think that's been spirituality, but it hasn't, Rachel. It's been a hybrid Duke's mixture, and it's actually been the discovery of the self, but it's not the discovery of the soul. The journey into the soul is a journey of discovering God, prayer, reflection, contemplation, and devotion.
I want to ask you about the soul, because a lot of people use that term.
Actually, a lot of people don't.
Well, I certainly encounter it. It's probably an occupational hazard. Mm-hmm. But soul is thrown around, spirit. It's such a mysterious concept. It's hard to know whether it's a metaphor, whether it's real. How does one objectify the soul? How do you define soul and spirit?
Spirit is the ego's expression of the soul. The spirit, to me, is what someone talks about at the level of earth consciousness. You know, put your spirit into it. Spirit is ego. The soul is what Teresa would call the castle, the interior, deep self that is accessed through silence, through prayer, through withdrawing from one's personal agenda with God. That's why that metaphor of the castle, to cross the drawbridge of the ego and get to someplace deeper within yourself, where you are able to sit in silence and say, be still, I know I am with God. Be still, I know I am with God. And leave a personal agenda at the drawbridge and say, I have no agenda with you, dear God. I don't even know how to speak to you, but I will begin with saying, I surrender. I have no personal agenda, and I will be still and wait and not chatter in my head, because I can't bear to have no sound in my head. And I won't talk to you like Santa Claus. Can I have? Can I have? Will you take care of? Can I have more? It's the spirit that chatters all the time. It's the spirit that has a Santa Claus list. And can I have more stuff? And where's my stuff? And and will you bless me and bless all my friends and family? And can I have that job? and make sure that the job has a pension plan, and I need to be successful, and that's the spirit. The soul says, I am here, I trust. There's the difference.
She certainly captures the self-obsessed refrain that's so popular these days. Carolyn Mace is certainly up there in the New Age stakes with a number of works on self-empowerment and healing. But today, she's my guest on the Spirit of Things Spiritual Classic Series here on ABC Radio National. And she's talking about Teresa of Avila's Interior Castle, which also inspired Carolyn's latest book, Entering the Castle. We'll find out more about her personal life in a moment. And do stay on for Jack Spong later in the program, who reveals something of his beginnings and how the spiritual classic he's chosen radically changed him from a small-town priest to a world-changing bishop. That's coming up later in the program. But now, back to Carolyn Mace, who was pretty critical of the me chatter of the New Age. Well, I certainly hear a lot of the spirit chatter from a great many people in the New Age movement who actually do promise these things, that so long as, you know, you do the right affirmations and the blessings.
There you go. What's an affirmation, Rachel, but a bargain? I want what I want. I want what I want. Just say it three times. That's witchcraft.
Well, Carolyn, it sounds like the seven mansions that Teresa of Avila had laid out for us are a much more difficult journey. How does one use it? How does one go through? And is it possible for you?
I think the word might be authentic than difficult, but go ahead.
Can you kind of summarize what that progression looks like?
Teresa says the journey into the soul is an exploration of self-knowledge that has everything to do with your relationship to discovering God or your blockages to God. So that is a fundamental definition. So let's take it the next step. The mansions, the seven mansions of the soul, each one takes you progressively closer to an intimate relationship to God or a progression of illumination to become clearer in your capacity to carry truth within you. What am I talking about there? When someone reads the work of great mystics, even Albert Einstein, who is qualifies as a mystic, eventually you will read somewhere in their writings a reference to how painful what they understand or how they understand the world to be is. Eventually, they will refer to the pain that they carry in their heart. Now, the ordinary mortal will interpret that as some kind of private little emotional pain of being lonely. But that's not it at all, Rachel. What they're referring to is the pain of holding a truth, of being able to comprehend a cosmic truth while still being in little mortal form, and the distance between that truth and this form. When Teresa or any of these great saints who organized a path of interior development, interior stamina, whether it was Ignatius Loyola or Buddha or any of them, what they are saying in the soul, because the mind can't do it, is you have to develop your soul step by step. And the reason you do it is because great truth gets revealed to you in meditation. Look at the cosmic, the actual cosmic power of forgiveness. And when that truth is actually revealed to you, it's revealed to you so that you start praying and carrying the pain of people who can't forgive. It's not about intellect. It's about what your soul is able to do on behalf of others. The mind is a jealous instrument, Rachel. The mind is not generous, and the mind is not capable of doing acts of generosity and love that the soul can do. But the soul has to be refined and built and trained as an instrument of love.
I want to ask you about that training, because
and that's what entering the castle is about.
I want to ask you about that training, because the language of the soul has often been identified as prayer. Mm-hmm. And Teresa of Avila was very much a good Catholic, and she was very focused on prayer. One could say that the interior castle was about developing the prayer life.
Map of prayer.
Is that one of the things that attracted you, Carolyn, to Teresa of Avila, the importance of prayer? I ask you that because you write in Entering the Castle about prayer and about how the actual, almost the liturgical, well, the Catholic Mass, for example, is a very important vehicle for entering the soul. And perhaps many people today have sort of cast aside things like prayer and have gone for affirmations and sort of intuition.
That's lazy. That's just being lazy. They don't get. People have dismissed, have lost any sense. They have no comprehension of what prayer is, of what the sacred is, of the fact that the sacred needs maintenance, that you do have to take off your shoes when you're on sacred ground. We've gotten very arrogant, Rachel. And I'm not talking about Catholicism. Yes, I come from a Catholic background, and I've come full circle, and I'm not a practicing Catholic in the sense of, I'm not a conservative Catholic in the least. I think the politics of the church are nonsense. I am a practicing mystic, and I am devoted to mystical teachings, whether in Catholicism or in Buddhism.
And does that entail prayer every day?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But let me give you an example of a prayer. Teresa, for example, one of her favorite prayers. Imagine that you go to bed at night and you're by yourself and you enter into this whole sense that you're in a cocoon and you quietly say, "Let nothing disturb the silence of this moment with you, dear God. Let nothing disturb the silence of this moment." And you remind yourself that I will not be afraid in this life. And as you look at your life, you dwell on this moment and you say, "Let nothing disturb the silence of this moment. This day of my life will never come again. This day will never come again. And I choose to spend my day, I choose to spend my evening, and I choose to spend my night in complete safety and gratitude in your company. I will not let myself wander into any frightened thoughts. I will stay in my sweet cocoon with you in this gentle truth that this day will never come again. This night will never come again, and nothing will disturb the silence of this moment." Now that is a prayer. Do I pray every day? You better believe it.
Carolyn Mace, what about you? I mean, Teresa of Avila was a nun, although she did live with a community and was the abbess of her community. And as you say, she established many monasteries, I think about 17.
Exactly 17. Well done. And they're all active. Today.
To this day.
They're all active.
Well, what about you? Do you live the singular life as a spiritual leader?
I am single, but not because I'm a spiritual leader. I mean, I had a partner for 8 years, and he and I had, I'm not sure where that's going to go. We're still
differences
in touch with each other, so I'm not sure. But I don't see that a deeply spiritual life and a personal life are mutually exclusive at all. Not at all. I'm not a nun. I don't intend to live like that. You know, maybe I was once upon a time. But even as a creative woman or as a businesswoman, I'm also a writer and I'm a teacher. And I have a very deep interior life. All of the above are true. I'm very devoted to my friends and my family. And I buy wild clothes and I love jewelry. So, I mean, like, all of the above are true. And that is a wonderful thing to know about me because I'm a gourmet cook. I do great gardening because the idea, the fear, we have a tremendous fear that by having a deep spiritual life, we're going to be single and celibate.
Because it's so demanding. And of course, Teresa of Avila's love was so focused on God. It seems like a substitute for other kinds of love.
Yeah, whereas the fact is, if you are imbalanced and psychologically depressed, you're going to be single because you're so demanding. If you're an unforgiving, bitter person, you're going to be single because who wants to live with you? Does that ever occur to people? Whereas if you're healthy, loving, with a rich interior life, who wouldn't want to live with you?
Carolyn Mace, spelled M-Y-S-S, has written Entering the Castle, An Inner Path to God and Your Soul, and she was my guest on this Spiritual Classics program. I'm Rachel Kahn. Thanks for joining me on The Spirit of Things this week. John Shelby Spong is well known to Australians, where his message of a Christian faith that's not beholden to a first century mentality has been welcomed by many, and they're not all Christians. People of other faiths also find his perspective refreshing and illuminating. He's a serious scholar, and his latest book, Jesus for the Non-Religious, builds on more than a century of New Testament scholarship. Both his heart and his head are passionately entwined in his exposition of what it means to be a person of faith. Jack Spong, welcome to Australia. It's great to have you back.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to see you again, to be back with you.
Well, Jack Spong, you've been welcomed by many Australians, about 900 who have registered for the Common Dreams Conference. But you've had the usual cold shoulder from the Sydney Anglican Diocese, which has accused you of sort of emptying Christianity of its fundamental beliefs. You must be pretty used to this kind of dichotomy when you arrive on the scene.
Yeah, that's true. I've known Peter Jensen for a long time, and he hadn't changed. This is not the first time he's done that. And I must say it's amusing to me that he would think I really want to speak in one of his churches. My audience, Rachel, is the people that his kind of religion offends. And they leave the church and they yearn for something. So I don't, you know, when he talks about gutting Christianity, what I'm doing, I suspect, or at least what he feels I'm doing, is gutting his degree of certainty and his level of fundamentalism, which I think is easily guttable. Christianity was a first century religion. It shaped itself in terms of a worldview of a three-tiered universe where miracles were happening every day. If you didn't understand it, you called it a miracle, where sickness was punishment from God. All sorts of concepts that 21st century people have long abandoned, but they still live in the hearts of ultra-conservative fundamentalists, and fundamentalist Christians come in both Catholic and Protestant varieties, so it's fairly common.
Well, that realization that the world had moved on was already apparent to one of your mentors, John T. Robinson, the Bishop of Woolwich, who wrote Honest to God, and it was published in 1963. Now, what a year that was. The Beatles came out of their cave in Liverpool and sort of turned the world of music and youth upside down. And John T. Robinson wrote that book, which ended up on the cover of Time magazine. And it fundamentally questioned the Christian framework.
That's correct.
It called people to a revolution of faith. What were you doing at that time?
I was a very young priest in a little town of Eastern North Carolina. And the first thing I noticed about that book, I didn't know John at that time at all, but the first thing I noticed is that people in my congregation had heard of the book and were beginning to ask me about it. And when a theological book gets to the people of your church before it gets to the local pastor, it means he better read it quickly. So I sort of put it aside, and, you know, I'd read enough reviews of it, and I said, well, you know, it's sort of secondhand stuff. That's the way you put down original people. You say, oh, that's all old hat. He quotes Bonhoeffer, and he quotes Tillich, and he quotes Bultmann, and I've read all three of those people, so this is nothing new. I put it on my book reading list, and we went to the beach in North Carolina that summer, and I read that book, and I read it again, and I read it again. I couldn't put it down. I read it three times from cover to cover. And what he did was to let the cat out of the bag. He put together all of the things that we had just sort of piecemealed, but they suddenly came together in a cohesive whole. And you could no longer say the things you used to say about God with integrity. Your consciousness was raised to a new dimension. And so I had to begin the process of rethinking what I believed, not because the experience was changed, but certainly the explanation of the experience had. Now, fortunately for me, it was in the summer that I read that book that I also moved from this little parish in eastern North Carolina to Lynchburg, Virginia, which was a very different kind of church. And every time a minister moves, he has a chance to recreate himself because he doesn't live in the expectations. And so I decided that if I was going to continue as an Anglican priest, that I would have to teach the Bible the way it had been taught to me in theological college. And so I started an adult class in that church, and I used Robinson's approach, and I used the biblical criticism approach that I'd learned in seminary. And I discovered a fascinating thing. Far from being offended, most of the people were very eager to learn that they don't have to be first century people to be believers. It was a freeing experience for them. Now, that didn't mean everybody likes it, because for most people, religion is a search for security, not a search for truth. And when new truth shatters their religious security, they're very uncomfortable, and so they want to leave. But I was determined that we would run one church in the city of Lynchburg that would be a place where people could come with their brains and could raise their questions and could not be told how dreadful and horrible they are. I got to know John in 1973 when I was still a priest, when he came on a tour. And then in 1978, when I was a bishop, I met him at Lambeth. And we were both so bored with Lambeth. There's nothing quite so boring as 500 bishops preaching last Sunday's sermon while they act as if they're in a debate. And so John and I began to take walks out into the woods of Kent. Every day we'd take a long two-hour walk and we would discuss the New Testament. It was one of the richest experiences I've ever had. And after that we corresponded and became good friends. And he was coming to lead a clergy conference for my clergy in May of the year he died in January. And he wrote me in the fall to tell me he'd gotten this diagnosis. And he sent me a copy of a sermon he had preached, I think at Clare Chapel at Cambridge, about what it means to know that you're dying. And it was really a powerful piece. He was probably one of three key mentors in my life. And I do quite deliberately feel that I take up his mantle of leadership and play the role that he has played in the life of the church.
John Robinson starts Honest to God with an interrogation of his faith, and particularly its dominant metaphysical ideas. And the main one that he starts with is the notion of a God up there, mm-hmm. which you find in the Gospel of Luke when you read about Christ's ascension into heaven. Robinson says that even if we don't accept a God up there, we at least accept a God out there. Was that an idea that you yourself were struggling with?
I think it probably was. I think it's one I've abandoned. I don't think there's a God up there or out there at all. I think spatial images for God are simply irrelevant. The problem, Rachel, is that most human beings don't know how to talk about God. We don't have a God language. We have only a human language. I say to people, can you imagine a horse describing what it means to be human? How can a horse get outside the boundaries of horseness and talk about what human life is? And we hear that, but when we begin to say, well, neither can a human being get outside of humanity and talk about what God is, because all of our gods wind up looking like great big human beings. That's just sort of inevitable. It was Xenophanes, the Greek philosopher, who said if horses had gods, they would look like horses. I think that all we can talk about is how we believe we experience God, not who God is. And I think any time you begin to talk about who God is or what God is, you've passed the boundary of human competence. I do think God is real, and I think people have experiences of God. Then they have to put those into human words. And what is an experience of God? Well, it might be a delusion. That's what Richard Dawkins says, God is a delusion. I think Richard Dawkins is wrong. I think God is a reality, but some people are quite delusional about their understanding of God. That's very true. But how do you talk about moments of expanded consciousness, moments where you transcend the limits, moments where time seems to stand still? I think that's the place we've got to begin to talk about how we experience whatever we call God, the transcendent, the holy, the other, whatever it is. Part of the difficulty with most people's understanding of God is that for their security's sake, they need God to be a parent figure in the sky who can take care of them. Christianity does not encourage us to grow up. It encourages us to stay children to some heavenly parent. I think that's why the Christian church uses the phrase, you must be born again, because every time you're born again, you're still a child. And what we really need is not to be born again. We need to grow into the maturity of accepting the responsibilities of being self-conscious human beings who live with the capacity of communing with the source of our life. That's what religion is.
Well, Robinson got a lot of his inspiration from Paul Tillich,
yes,
who talked about that depth, that inexhaustible depth of being, the ground of being. Now, that depth is what God means, according to Tillich.
I think that's right, and Tillich was my teacher too. And I still resonate. I went back maybe 8 or 9 years ago and decided I would reread all of Paul Tillich's works just to see how far I had been shaped by him. You know, after a while, you think it's your idea. And what he's doing, what John Robinson was doing, was to try to get away from the God understood theistically as a being supernatural in power who lives somewhere above the sky and who periodically invades the world and does miraculous things. Now, that's clearly the majority God in the biblical story. That's the God who can split the Red Sea. That's the God who can dictate the Torah to Moses at Mount Sinai. That's the God who raises up prophets. But there are also some minority voices in the Hebrew Scriptures that I think we ignore. God is referred to as the wind that animates life, the ruach. God is referred to as love by the first epistle of St. John, and people say, well, that's not Jewish. Oh, yes, the New Testament is a Jewish book, too. The Christian church didn't separate from the synagogue until 88 of the common era, 58 years after the death of Jesus. It needs to reclaim its Jewish roots. And the Hebrews talked about God as a rock. That's a pretty impersonal symbol. And I think that's as close as the Hebrews could come to what Tillich meant by the ground of being. A rock is firm. You stand on a rock, it doesn't give way. What Tillich is suggesting is that the very being of God is that in which we are rooted, and the more deeply and fully we become ourselves, the more we reveal the God who is the ground of all being. And I think that's what the Christian message ought to be concentrating on. I think that to worship God says that you believe life is holy. To be a Christian, I believe, means that you say life is ultimately loved. And to talk about God as Holy Spirit means to me that you are called to be all that you are capable of being, because the Holy Spirit is always the source of life, the giver of life. Now, those are sort of non-personal symbols, and yet they result in an intense and enhanced personal quality of life. You can't be a full human being if you don't love yourself, if you don't feel you're holy. You can't be a full human being unless you feel that the self you are, with all your faults, is nonetheless loved, and you're called into transcending those limitations. And I don't think you can worship the God who is the ground of being without having the courage to be who you are.
So what you're really doing is closing that gap between the individual and God. Can I ask you to read from John Robinson's Honest to God, in which he quotes Tillich and then comments on him?
I'd be happy to do that. This is on page 55 of his little book, which sold more copies than any book since Pilgrim's Progress in England, any religious book, rather remarkable achievement. He says, there are depths of revelation, intimations of eternity, judgments of the holy and the sacred, awarenesses of the unconditional, the numinous, and the ecstatic, which cannot be explained in purely naturalistic categories without being reduced to something else. This is the thus saith the Lord heard by the prophet, the apostle, and the martyr, for which naturalism cannot account. But neither can it discount it merely by pointing to the fact that the Lord is portrayed in the Bible in highly mythological terms, as one who inhabits eternity, who walks in the garden in the cool of the evening. The question of God is the question whether this depth of being is a reality or an illusion, not whether a being exists beyond the bright blue sky or anywhere else. Belief in God is a matter of what you take seriously without any reservation of what for you is ultimate reality. That's straight out of Tillich, that's straight out of John Robinson. And that's the cornerstone of most of the things I write, so I really am the child of these two people.
Jack Spong there revealing the theological tradition that informs his thought, including the spiritual classic Honest to God by the English Anglican Bishop John T. Robinson. You're tuned to ABC Radio National, and I'm Rachel Kahn. Glad to have your company for this edition of the Spirit of Things Spiritual Classics series, where my guest today is John Shelby Spong, who likes to be known as Jack Spong, the author of Jesus for the Non-Religious. Is this really the end of theism?
I think so. You know, the English language is a funny language. When you say somebody is an atheist, you think that means that that person no longer believes in God. But that word really means that a person is no longer a theist. And theism is a particular definition of God. It's a God understood as a being, supernatural in power, dwelling external to this world, usually thought of as above the sky, and relating to this world periodically by invading it with supernatural, miraculous behavior to accomplish the divine will, to answer people's prayers, whatever. And I think that God died years ago. I think what happened in the revolution of Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Einstein, and Hubble's telescope is that we destroyed the dwelling place of God above the sky. You know, we know that there's not a roof up there, that it's infinite space. We know that the Earth is a tiny little planet revolving around a middle-class sun in a galaxy of billions and billions of stars, and that beyond our single galaxy, the Milky Way, there are billions and billions of galaxies, and it's infinite. So when God moves from above the sky to beyond outer space, God gets very, very distant. And I think both analogies finally have to be dismissed. I think we've got to begin to think of God as a life force that flows through the universe.
A kind of ultimate reality that exists.
That's right, yeah. And I think you discover that God by living. I'm merely a life-centered person. I don't understand that kind of religion that squelches life, that says you're a wretched, miserable sinner and you need to be rescued, and the only way God can rescue is to kill the divine Son on the cross. I find those are really strange, barbaric ideas. But they permeate the Christian faith. We've almost developed a fetish about the blood of Jesus. If you're a Catholic, you drink it sacramentally so you can be cleansed inside, and if you're a Protestant, you get washed in it. I think Protestants have more sense of external sins and Catholics more sense of internal sins, maybe. But, you know, those images are so barbaric and so gross, and yet they permeate this story. I don't think that the cross is the story where Jesus pays the price for human sin. I think the cross is the place where a full human life reveals that you can give your life away totally in love if you possess your life, and that's what divinity means to me. It doesn't mean that you're a masquerading deity wearing human flesh and walking around in the life of this world, but that's the way we've thought of it. That theism is dying because atheism does not mean you do not believe in God. It's that you dismiss the theistic definition of God, which drives you, I think, to try to find a different way to describe not God, but your God experience.
Well, in Honest to God, Robinson was wrestling with that idea with the very tenacious belief that Jesus is God and that the apostles followed him because he was God. But Robinson argues that Jesus didn't claim to be God, and therefore what Jesus was really doing was demonstrating that God acted through him. And this is an invitation then, I think, that Robinson issues to everyone, that God can act through
That's
all of
right.
us?
I think that's right. For John Robinson, Jesus is different from you only by degree, not by kind. John wasn't the first person to come up with that idea. I can find that in Meister Eckhart in the 14th century. It's always been a kind of undercurrent in Christian thinking, minority. I think it's destined to be the majority in the future, but you can't ever be sure about that. What we need to recognize is that for most people, their religion is part of their security system. And it demands a supernatural being who can do all the things they cannot do, who can protect when they can't protect. And people feel bereft and alone if that theistic God is sort of challenged or taken away. And yet, when you look at life, that theistic God doesn't do very well. If God has the supernatural power, able to intervene and stop a hurricane and doesn't do it, Is that because God hates the poor of New Orleans? Or if God has the power to stop a tsunami and doesn't do it, does that mean that God wanted those 350,000 people to die? It becomes a very problematic thing when you think of it in a broader pattern. And I think that God is quite unbelievable. But I think God, whatever I mean by that, and I struggle to find words, I see God as a life force flowing through all living things but coming to self-consciousness in human life. I see God as the power of love that I think also flows through the universe, everything from the photosynthesis of a plant that turns to catch the rays of the sun to a mother cat licking her baby kitten. I think that's the presence of the love of God, but they don't know it because they're not self-conscious. And that love comes to self-consciousness again in human beings, and we can talk about it.
So then, was the point of the mythologizing one finds in the New Testament, according to Robinson and Bultmann, who, after all, was the person who talked about all of these stories as myths, was the point of all that to show that there was a transcendent meaning to Jesus' life, that it was something bigger than ordinary life?
I think that's what they're trying to say. I think that the power that you see in Jesus' life is the fullness of his humanity, which is so rare. And the degree to which you are fully human, I think they would be saying, that which we call God can live in you and flow through you, so that they saw Jesus as sort of an ultimate revelation of God. But remember, we don't have a God language. We've got only a human language. And when you're trying to describe a God experience in human language, you have to use mythological words and you have to use expanded symbols. And I think what they do in the biblical story is that they take the language that they know best and they expand it. One of the things that I did in this book, and I think that moves a step beyond where John Robinson was, I've gone back and argued that so many of the stories in the New Testament about Jesus are simply magnified Moses stories and magnified Elijah stories. The best illustration of that I know is the story of the Ascension, which makes no sense in a space age. But if you go back and read the story of Elijah, you'll find that he just ascended into heaven. And right before he ascended, he passed on his authority to his single disciple, Elisha. And Elisha asked a final deathbed kind of request. And Elisha said, I can't be your successor unless you endow me with a double portion of your spirit. And Elijah says, well, I don't know that I can do that for you because that's not mine to give. But he said, if you see me ascending into the sky, then you'll know that your request has been granted. And at that moment, according to this wonderful Hebrew story, a magical fiery chariot swooped out of the clouds, drawn by magical fiery horses, and picked up Elijah. You know, it's as if it was a stop on a bus route, and Elijah hops right on board and says goodbye. And then God provides a whirlwind to propel this magical chariot into the sky, and Elisha sees, and he knows that he's going to be the recipient of a double portion of Elijah's spirit. Now, you fast forward in the Judeo-Christian story, 850 years, and you have another life named Jesus. They call him Yeshua, if you were speaking in the Aramaic. And people began to believe that they saw a God presence in him that was greater than the God presence they had ever known in any of the other heroes of their faith tradition. And this is not to say Christianity is superior to Judaism. It's to remember that these were Jewish people trying to incorporate this new Jewish Jesus into their ongoing faith story. And so Luke, who is the only one to tell us the Ascension story, quite obviously has Elijah in mind. And he portrays Jesus as new and greater Elijah. Elijah needed a fiery chariot and fiery horses and a whirlwind. Jesus has the power to ascend on his own. Elijah could only give a double portion of his human spirit to his single disciple. Jesus can give the infinite power of the Holy Spirit to the whole gathered community, sufficient to last through all the ages. And Luke then takes the whirlwind that propelled Elijah heavenward, and he turns it into the mighty rushing wind that fills the room, and he takes the fire from the chariot, and he makes that the tongues of fire that dance on the heads of the people at the time of Pentecost. Now, I don't think there's any question that Luke knew that he was magnifying an Elijah story. What happened in the Christian faith is that from about 125 on, there were very few Jews in the Christian faith any longer. It had become a Gentile movement. And so from about 125 until maybe the last 20 years of the 20th century, the only people that read the Bible, the New Testament, the only people who wrote commentaries were Gentiles who were abysmally ignorant about the Jewish background. And so they tended to literalize these stories, and that's the problem that we've gotten into.
So actually what you're pointing to is that those stories and that mythology was understood to be in some sense symbolic.
That's correct.
And
absolutely.
That makes me think that perhaps we will always be seeing these mythological stories as beloved and as our language
for the
transcendent.
That's the only language we've got. Those are all attempts to explain the experience. You literalize the explanations and they become nonsense. You go through the explanations and try to touch the experience and it becomes life-changing.
Well, your work has been life-changing for so many people, and your latest book, Jesus for the Non-Religious, is, one could say, almost a culmination of some of the ideas that were laid out in John Robinson's Honest to God.
I see that book as bringing some of John Robinson's work to conclusion. John was treated in the Church of England very much the way any person who thinks outside the box would be treated in Sydney or other parts of the religious world.
As you are treated.
Yeah, but because, you know, they can't incorporate those thoughts into their narrow frame of reference. But if you don't get outside the box, the enterprise, it seems to me, dies. John was never allowed to be more than a suffragan or assisting bishop. Woolwich is an assisting diocese in Southwark. After a while, he finally despaired of his career in the church, and so he resigned, and he went back to Cambridge, where he had been a lecturer in New Testament with a Cambridge PhD. And when he went back to Cambridge, they wouldn't restore him to the status he had before he was elected a bishop. He was never appointed a lecturer. And so he lived the rest of his life in a fairly junior position as the dean of the chapel in that particular college at Cambridge. And he died very young, it seems to me, before his career was over. But it was a milestone, and the church ostracized him. The Archbishop of Canterbury said some fairly terrible things about him when Honest to God came out. In his credit, the Archbishop said that was one of the biggest mistakes of his career about 20 years later. Today in England, if you're going to do work at Cambridge on a PhD on a 20th century Church of England leader, John Robinson is about 10 to 1, the people that are chosen. So he's come into his own. But that's the way it is with a prophet. You know, prophets are not popular. You don't want to volunteer to be a prophet because they don't have a good life expectancy. But John Robinson lifted the church to a new vision, and the church has incorporated a great deal of that. I hope I will lift the church to a new vision. I don't expect to be universally popular because people are frightened about that new vision. But I'll let history, I'm happy to have history be my judge. And 50 years from now, we'll see whether or not I made a contribution or not.
The retired Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, in the United States, John Shelby Spong, and he recently celebrated his 76th birthday. With a mind like that, he could be going strong for the next 20 years. Critics beware. If you missed any part of my guests, Carolyn Mace and Bishop Spong, you can listen again on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. You'll find a transcript there as well, and if you're clever enough, you'll be able to download the audio. The program was originally broadcast on the 2nd of September 2007. And that's the last of our summer programs for the year. It was produced by me and Jeff Wood. For the past 5 weeks, we've been revisiting our Spiritual Classics series from 2007, and I hope you've enjoyed the opportunity to do some spiritual time traveling. And a reminder that you'll also find transcripts of the series online. Next week, the Spirit of Things returns, refreshed and renewed. So until then, so long from me, Rachel Kahn.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.